Hey, this is the very good Dr. Glenn Livingston, and I am here with the very good Howard Jacobson. How are you, Howie?
Very well, Glenn. Happy to be talking to you on this beautiful Friday.
And Howie is the co-author of a very interesting new book called Proteinaholic. Howie, could you pronounce the full name of your co-author so that I don't get that wrong?
Sure, Garth Davis, MD.
Garth Davis, MD, who is a formerly famous bariatric surgeon and has kind of radically reversed his position on a lot of things, which I'm always very impressed with. Some of the people that I see, because I think that's one of the hallmarks of good science, is it's supposed to be self-correcting, and even if you have a public position based upon a supposedly scientific position, that if the science changes, you're supposed to change the position, and that's one of the things that impressed me about this book right off the bat. But Howie, tell me a little bit about the book.
It's Garth's journey, which I think probably has three parts to it. The first part is his standard medical training, and it was quite good. And he was class president at UT Austin, University of Texas. He was a board certified bariatric surgeon. By the age of 35, he had his own reality TV show on TLC called Big Medicine. By 2007, he had been hired to write a book called The Expert's Guide to Weight Loss Surgery. So this guy kind of had it all, and he was the very flower of American medicine in terms of his skill, his status, the regard in which he was held, the success of his practice. And at the same time, he was overweight, miserable. He had such terrible irritable bowel syndrome that wherever he went, he had to find out where the bathroom was and sit or stand as close to it as possible. He never exercised, and he was on diet after diet, from Atkins to South Beach to Sugar Busters, to the extent that when they opened up a Wendy's inside his hospital, he would get the hamburger without the bun. All of that was starting to cause some degree of cognitive dissonance in this guy who is this supposed paragon of health, weight loss expert, who lived in his scrubs because he said they're just the most forgiving uniform if you have too much weight.
Right.
And a couple of things caused him to have a moment of reconsideration. What almost did it was his first child was due to be born, and he had to go for a life insurance policy exam, which he failed. Apparently, his numbers were so bad that they weren't going to give him the standard policy. They were going to give him some sort of substandard policy, and the doctor who administered it also had given him three prescriptions that he was to be on for life, for statins, for high blood pressure, for something else. He was amazed to discover that he had cholesterol in his eyeballs. He didn't really know was possible in a relatively healthy young American male. And that kind of shook him up. But what really got him to question everything was a kind of a funny story, which we describe in the beginning of the book, where he was contacted by the Houston Chronicle to be featured as the cover story on their health issue. He's got the TV show, he's got the book, good looking, wealthy, socialite. And so he says, "Sure, I'll be featured." And they said, "Great, let's start the interview. Tell me, what do you do for exercise?" He goes, "I run the stairs at Rice Stadium," by which he meant once or twice in the past, I've run stairs at Rice Stadium.
Got it.
And they said, "Great, let's do a photo shoot."
Oh, no.
So, first thing he did, he had to go out and buy running clothes because he didn't own any exercise clothes. He's a very competitive guy. So, he actually set it up and he started running those steps like an SOB, huffing and puffing, but he wasn't going to let anyone show him up. And he was one series of steps after the other. They kept snapping the photos, and he just felt like he wanted to crawl into a hole and die. He's like, "Well, you know what? I better get back to the hospital now." And they said, "Great, one more shot, the victory shot at the top." And so they took a picture of him standing at the top, arms out like Rocky, smiling. It's a great shot. I found it online in archive.org, and it's an amazing photo because it really could fool you. And then he said he race walked to the men's room where he knelt in front of the toilet and threw up his all-American breakfast of bacon and eggs. And he says at that moment, he knew he had to change.
Interesting. It wasn't a matter of knowing what to do the next day, though, because there was a whole sequence of re-education and having to evaluate the literature. I mean, it's very confusing what's out there. Anybody you talk to about health and well-being has another opinion about the way that you should eat. And I think right now paleo is kind of hot in the diet market. And how did he figure it out?
He didn't know whether there was a thing to be figured out. Right. He had learned as a doctor that the human body is basically a lemon. It's going to break down over time. And that's why we have drugs and surgeries to kind of patch you up and keep you going. But this disease process is pretty much inevitable. So the first thing he had to do was find out if that was true. And he'd read somewhere in a journal something that kind of floored him and didn't fit with his reality as a red-blooded American from Texas, which is that the United States wasn't the number one country in terms of health. And he started doing research just comparatively in different countries on health outcomes. And he found that America was number one in health spending, spending about twice as much as the next country in line, but our outcomes were far worse. I did some checking on this for the book, and the CIA keeps statistics on longevity, life expectancy around the world. The United States is number 42.
Wow.
We have more diseases of affluence than just about any other country, meaning heart disease, cancer, diabetes, macular degeneration, kind of the diseases of excess. And the more he studied, the more he realized that there were really different rates of disease around the world, and they seemed to be related a little bit to lifestyle. So the first book that he really seriously got into is called Blue Zones by a guy named Dan Buettner, who was hired by National Geographic to lead expeditions around the world to discover where people lived the longest healthy lives. So not hooked up to machines, but vigorous, taking part in their communities, active, all their marbles, living the kind of life we would want to live into our 80s, 90s, and hundreds. This book pinpointed five spots around the world that they called blue zones, where people live to be 100 routinely, where dying at 80 is considered a bit tragic. Like for us, you know, dying at 50 or 60. That was there. 80 is the new 60 in these places. There was a place in Costa Rica, in a Greek island, Okinawa, Japan, and Sardinia, Italy. The fifth one was in the United States, in Loma Linda, California, the Seventh-day Adventist enclave community. He said, well, so what do these people all have in common? And the book points to nine things that most of them have in common and three things that all of them have in common. And the biggest one was a plant-based diet, high in complex carbohydrates and low in protein.
And so that led him in that direction for himself?
He couldn't believe it. Look at Okinawa, the longest life expectancy for women in the world, about 10 years longer than we have in America. And they get about 70% of their calories from this one purple yam. And he's like, but we were told carbs are bad. Stay away from potatoes. They're going to make you fat. They're going to give you diabetes. They're going to make you sick. How can the longest lived people in the world, the healthiest people in the world, be eating the exact diet that we were all told not to eat? In his book for weight loss surgery, he'd recommended post-surgery a zone diet, 40% carbs, 30% fat, 30% protein. And to see this evidence that around the world, people eat the opposite and are healthy was very troubling to him.
How does that happen, though?
Well, the human body is meant to eat carbohydrates. You remember your 12th grade biology or whenever you took it, there's the Krebs cycle, in which carbohydrates, and specifically sugars, are converted into ATP, which is used by the mitochondria of each cell for energy. So our bodies are meant to run on carbohydrates in the same way that a car is meant to run on high test unleaded or regular unleaded or diesel. And you can sometimes swap out different grades of fuel, but the performance suffers. The engine gets clogged up. It doesn't last as long, and the fuel economy isn't as great, and the car moves sluggishly. And the same thing is true when we don't eat the diet our bodies have evolved to eat.
But how is it possible that a nation which is known for medicine and science, that we could reach such an unbelievably erroneous conclusion and the culture could really believe just the opposite? How does that happen?
It's a great question. I think the answer is partly money. Well, I think the answer is mostly money.
Okay.
And money then operates via various mediating factors to pull its influence. So first of all, the mainstream of American medicine doesn't really buy into paleo. Bariatric surgeons do as a group. But if you look at mainstream stuff like Mayo Clinic or American Heart Association or even the U.S. government's dietary recommendations – they kind of recommend lower fat, eat your fruits and vegetables, The prescriptions are quite vague. They get eviscerated in committee by lobbyists and by politicians in the pockets of big food and big animal agriculture. The impetus for the science generally is sort of a run-of-the-mill, eat your veggies, don't have so much red meat. The paleo movement is a whole other thing. The problem is that there's a lot of industries that make a lot of money by selling us food. And so one of them is the processed food industry, which makes almost everything that we buy in the supermarket, except for the stuff that's refrigerated or in the produce section. And they produce about 4,000 calories per person per day. And we're marketers. We know that the job of a marketer is to move product, is to create demand where it doesn't exist and fill it and flame it where it does exist. So there's an entire industry of marketers devoted to selling us 4,000 calories a day for every man, woman, and child. And vegetables tend to not have that many calories in them. If we're trying to get rid of calories, it's processed foods, it's sugars, it's baked goods, it's pizzas, hamburgers, hot dogs, high fat, high protein foods, very calorically dense.
But even so, Howie, even with the financial incentives, you can't just go and marketing expertise to create problems that might not exist. You still can't go out and say, well, this is really healthy when it's not. I mean, there's still FTC oversight and claims that have to be validated. And I'm familiar with several companies that are making what are ostensibly scientific claims, and they say they have the studies to back them up. How can you have a whole series of scientific studies to back up something which really is the opposite of what the Blue Zones had found?
Right. Okay, well, I'll give you three answers. And let's go from least to most cynical. Okay? So one answer is, when you look at research, most scientists want to do what's called randomized clinical trials, and ideally randomized double-blind or even triple-blind clinical trials, which is sort of the gold standard, where you take a group of people, you randomize them into different groups, two or more, and you compare different treatment options, whether it's diet or a drug or a therapy or some other protocol. And that way you can say, well, because they were randomized, the groups were essentially the same before the treatment, and so any changes between the groups at the end must be due to the treatment.
And Howard, just for the sake of nomenclature, double-blind means the experimenters don't know which groups people were randomized into, and triple-blind means what?
The experimenters don't know, the participants don't know, and the people doing the data analysis afterwards don't know.
Got it.
So it's just another layer. That's very rare. But it's generally double-blind is considered a gold standard. So if you're going to take people and randomize them, it's very easy to do for, let's say, a drug trial. You give half of them a placebo, or you give half of them the standard of care and half of them get the new drug, and then you follow them and you see what happens. And that's what the randomized controlled trial was designed to do, a controlled intervention. Now, you could also do the same thing for, let's say, a psychological treatment, right? You could randomize 100 people, 50 of them get CBT, 50 of them go to Alcoholics Anonymous, and then you can see which group does better with their drinking over time. But when you're trying to randomize people to a lifestyle, can you see how that would break down? I'm going to take 100 people and I'm going to randomly assign 50 of them to eat a high protein diet, 50 of them to eat a whole food plant-based diet that they've never heard of before. Unless you take these people and you lock them up and you control what they eat, randomization for lifestyle doesn't actually work. It's a bad model.
Because most people can't stick to the diet that they plan to eat this week without the intervention of a scientist, so much less when you then have to deal with a totally different diet that you didn't plan for yourself in the first place.
Right. Even if you could get people to do it, it's also not realistic. It's not relevant to the real world because people don't get randomized into lifestyles. People choose their lifestyles. So you're actually confounding the experiment by giving someone a lifestyle. They're much less likely to follow it. They're less likely to embrace it. They're less likely to own it. And they're less likely to share it with others. And we all know that teaching is one of the best ways to learn something.
So you have to find populations who are already eating different lifestyles and then compare and contrast in that way.
Right. And so when you look at America, nobody in America eats like Okinawans eat, by and large. Right, so 99% of the population eats some variation of a standard American diet, high in fat, high in protein, high in processed foods. The average American gets 5% of their calories from fresh fruits and vegetables, and half of that is potatoes in the form of French fries and potato chips. So there's a problem called the sick community problem when you're trying to do research. Let's look at it this way. Suppose everybody in America smoked cigarettes. As soon as the toddler was old enough to not burn down the house and hold the thing, they were smoking cigarettes. 100% of Americans smoke. There would be lung cancer in America. It might even be epidemic proportions. Maybe 50% of the population would die of lung cancer. But not everyone would get it, and not everyone who got it would die from it. Right? Because there's a bell curve of genetic susceptibility to lung cancer. But researchers, if they were trying to figure out the causes of lung cancer, they would look and it would look completely random. Or it would look like genetics. We have to do more genetic testing. Because there's no variability in the main variable, smoking, there's no way to see that smoking is correlated to lung cancer.
Yep. And to put that in context for the marketers that are listening to this, it's kind of like when you have a whole population of non-buyers. If you're not selling enough, there's no way to figure out why people are buying versus why they're not buying, because there's no variation in the population. This is an interesting analogy. If everybody purchased, you'd have no way to distinguish the buyers and the non-buyers either. I've never seen that happen.
For marketers.
Yeah.
So the studies that have been done, another analogy that Caldwell Esselstyn uses, a doctor out of the Cleveland Clinic who's done amazing clinical trials with diet. It's like the dietary trials, the big ones, are like crash test speed tests where you're crashing cars into brick walls at 100 miles an hour and 90 miles an hour and 80 miles an hour. And in all three cases, the dummy dies. And so you state that speed is irrelevant to car crash mortality.
Right. Right.
Nobody ever gets down to 20 or 10 or 5 or cars that stand still.
Can you bring that back to the food study problem?
Yeah, let's say the Harvard Nurses Study or the Harvard Health Professionals Study found that there's a very modest impact of reducing fat on, let's say, breast cancer. Recently, there was a headline in Time magazine, Butter is Back. There was a saturated fat study that said we can't really find correlations between saturated fat and heart disease. And so now everyone is saying, oh, see, they were wrong about saturated fat. Well, I went and I looked at the studies. So first I looked at these meta-analyses. A meta-analysis is just a collection of studies. And like anything else, you get out what you put in. And so you have to choose studies that ideally are going to represent the full range of good studies. Almost all of these studies that they chose did something called statistical adjustment. And this is complex. But one of the things they adjusted for was cholesterol, meaning that cholesterol was removed as a variable. If you have two people, one has high cholesterol and one has low cholesterol, you do a statistical sleight of hand to equalize them. But if saturated fat causes heart disease via cholesterol, you've just erased that factor. And it was done for cholesterol. It was done for body mass index. It was done for blood pressure. It was done for other elements of the lipid panel. So across the board, the people who ran the study decided to adjust for almost everything, which made it almost impossible to find a correlation between saturated fat and heart disease. The other thing they did was each of the trials was a different population, and they did not compare from one population to another. So they compared the thins to the thins. They put the thins in five quintiles, those who ate the lowest saturated fat, those who ate the highest, and they did the same with the Japanese. And they found not that much difference within the groups. When you look between the groups, though, the Japanese have something like five times lower rate of heart disease than people in Finland to saturated fat. But when you only compare within groups, it's another way of erasing significant differences. That was the first part. We're going to do it in order of cynicism. The book is called Proteinaholic, and the title reflects the fact that we are addicted to this idea of protein. So you and I are the same age. We grew up in the time when all of a sudden fat was demonized and everything had to be low fat.
Which is why I frequently had an entire Intamin's cake on the way home because it was fat-free.
There you go. It says it right there on the top.
Or a couple of boxes of Snackwell's fat-free cookies. I remember all that.
Yep. The 100-calorie packs. And we're supposed to cut down on our fat. We have skim milk, lean white meat chicken without the skin. We didn't actually eat a lot less fat. It turns out when you look at the statistics, our fat percentage went down a little bit because we increased our consumption of soda, but the amount of fat didn't go down. We just increased our calories by adding more soda, and so the percentage of fat dropped a little bit in our diet, but we didn't eat any less fat. So, but then you have this whole Atkins movement, the low-carb movement, that said, no, fat is good, and it's carbs that are the villain. So now we have this rock'em sock'em brawl between carbs and fat, which only leaves one other major source of calories, protein. And while the two of them are duking it out, protein has always had a bit of a halo, because protein is the thing that rich people can afford in excess. And protein is the thing that poor people would have at festivals, on holidays, weddings, special occasions. They would have meat. Otherwise, it was too expensive. So protein was this thing that in small quantities actually improves people's health because it was a kind of a buffer against starvation. It was seen as the ultimate food because it's what rich people could eat. And for a long time, the masses could get so little animal protein into their bodies that there was no discernible harm. It actually helped. The more protein you got, it helped because we were so far on the left of that bell curve.
You're talking about going back hundreds of years, or you're talking about in our country in this century?
Even this century. This century has been the one in which all of a sudden we have a chicken in every pot. The only reason we can afford to eat so many animals is because of our oil economy. If we weren't using an oil-based agricultural system, meaning fertilizer, herbicides, pesticides, transportation, heating and cooling of animal factory farm facilities and processing facilities, if we had our farming that we had 100 years ago, a big farm would have 50 cows, we would be eating a lot less meat. So this is a blip in human history. Grow field after field of soybeans, corn, wheat, and feed them to our animals, and then process millions and millions of animals a year, billions, actually. If we were back to 100 years ago and we were doing things manually with solar energy and human power and horsepower and ox power, we would be eating mostly plants and very, very few animals. And that appears to be the healthiest way for humans to eat. It's how we evolved. It's what we evolved to eat, largely plants and small amounts of animal foods.
What it really boils down to is that scientific research method and design, scientific analysis, the reporting and scientific studies, it's a much more complex field than the layman would believe, and virtually no non-scientists are really equipped to understand and dig deeper into what a scientific report really means.
Yeah, that's true, and it's also true that most scientists don't understand statistics.
That's interesting. I know the human brain is not really equipped to think statistically unless you train it to do so. Say a little bit more about most scientists not understanding science or statistics.
It's a very complex topic. It's one of your areas of tremendous expertise. Most scientists will take a couple of courses. They'll take statistics 101 and 201, maybe some biostatistics. But when you look at studies, you see how many of them get the power number wrong. The whole study is based on having the power to see the answer. So imagine you're going to do a study to see whether this coin is honest or not, whether it'll be 50% heads or 50% tails. You only have time to do two flips. And you say, well, we'll find out. If it's one head and one tail, then it's an honest coin. So you know that the chances of getting two heads or two tails is very, very high. In that case, that study would have an insufficient power to determine reality.
One out of four times you did that study, you should get two heads or two tails.
Yeah, one out of four times two heads, one out of four times two tails. So you have a 50% chance of mistakenly saying that that coin was dishonest if it was honest, and the converse is true. That study just wouldn't have enough power. The other thing I wanted to say before we go to the full coin story is that where I think people are really falling down, I think there are journalists, science journalists, health journalists, who are not doing their job, who are not asking for multiple sources, who do not understand science well enough, and they're just reporting what the PR departments of universities and think tanks are coming up with.
I've actually had that experience. I've done well-sampled national surveys and put out a press release and wound up in major periodicals and TV shows without anybody asking me how I arranged to sample it. They saw the PhD after my name. They figured that I must be telling the truth. I must have done all the rigor. They were extraordinarily busy. Like, they were calling me an hour before their deadline. And I wound up with national attention for something which I could have easily lied about. I didn't. It was all entirely true, but I could have easily lied about, or I could have just been lazy. I could have lied to myself or could have not understood the scientific rigor that's supposed to go into a survey. And I remember feeling a little bit frightened that I got all that attention for something that nobody asked me, well, did you do a stratified random sample and how did you randomize people? And nobody asked me any of that stuff. So
right. And journalists don't do it. And very few editors of best peer-reviewed journals actually require that kind of rigor. They don't ask for the data sets. Very often, the study that somebody wants to do will get changed halfway through because they're not getting the results they want, and there's pressure, overt or subtle, from the funder, and they're supposed to say that this was the study we were going to do, and here's why we changed it, but they often just write the paper as if the study they ended up with was the one they intended to do all along. So let's tell the coin story, because this is the third part, the most cynical part. So let's say you are the dairy industry in America, and you're trying to prove that milk is good for you, because milk is on the ropes a little bit. Kids don't really like to drink it. You've got to sugar it up and chocolate it up to get them to drink it at lunch. And the milk mustache campaign is getting old. So you want to do some scientific studies that show that milk is correlated with, let's say, some antibody that's linked to longevity or some protective growth factor against cancer or something like that. And you know that if you do the study, if you're going to put 10,000 people into the study and do it all at once, you know you're not going to get the result you want. But if you take those 10,000 people and you divide them into different studies of 100 people each, just like those coins, a certain percentage of the time you're going to get randomly a significant result. So let's say 80% of the time you run these 10,000 people through 100 studies of 100 people each. And let's say 90 of those studies are inconclusive. Milk doesn't help. 5 of the studies shows that milk is significantly harmful, and 5 of those studies show that milk has a protective effect. So if the truth is that the milk has no connection to this thing whatever, then the 90% are correct. But if you're paying for the studies, you only publish the 5 positive ones.
That assumes bad actors. That assumes malicious intent.
Yeah, well, it's either malicious or there was a great study that was done, I think in 2007, it was a survey of scientists called Scientists Behaving Badly. And it asked anonymously scientists to describe whether they've done any of a whole bunch of things, including changing study results, removing outliers, which is data points that don't fit with the majority of the data set, changing diagnostic criteria, doing all sorts of things that are not outright lying, but all would tend to move the study in the direction that the funding agency would like. And about 20% of scientists admitted to it. And you and I know that the response bias means that people who didn't respond probably did it a lot more. And there's a self-report bias that people, even in anonymous surveys, want to appear better than they are. The really interesting thing was the longer the person had been a scientist, the more likely they were to engage in these slightly shady behaviors.
Is that just because the financial pressure builds up over time?
I think it's financial pressure. I think there's more at stake. I think there's more pride in their views. Like the very first thing you said about Garth is that, you know, it's impressive that someone changed his mind. Well, when, you know, if you have books out and you're known for having...
Oh, I see. They dig in. They dig into a position and then there's a lot of dissonance involved in presenting data to the contrary.
Right. And, you know, as a marketer, I can feel that in myself. If I'm working with someone who all of a sudden is paying half of my bills, I can forgive a lot of stuff, you know? I can feel my moral fibers unraveling a little bit. The needier I am, the more I can say, well, you know, I can justify whatever. Someone will do it if they won't.
Yep.
I think there are evil players, but I think most people are trying to do their job. They're trying to put food on their table. They're trying to get advanced in their careers. And they honestly believe their positions because there's so much out there to support their position. All these other studies that are done in the same way.
Exactly. Okay, cool. We finished the coin study then. The coin study was that if you flipped it 1,000 times and looked at any given set of 100, you might not see a 50-50 fair coin experiment, but the thousandth of coin study would be much more likely to trend towards 50%. And you could, if you wanted to prove it was a biased coin, you could just publish the groups of 100 that were 52 or 53%, and then it would look like it was a biased coin.
Correct. That if you have the funding, you can get any result you want.
There's a story in the book about a journalist, or was it Gartner himself, who got widespread publicity for a study about chocolate making you lose weight in order to prove the point. Could you just say what happened with that?
Yeah, this was a study out of Austria, something like the Nonprofit Institute for Nutrition and Health. The lead researcher, Johannes Bohanen, published a study showing that eating chocolate, just adding dark chocolate to your diet, you know, in a chocolate bar, contributed to weight loss. And this was picked up by the Irish Times. It was picked up by a newspaper in India. It made it to TV stations in America. It was featured in the June 2015 issue of Shape magazine. And then Johannes Bohanen revealed in an IO9 article that he was John Bohanen, Harvard researcher, and he was doing a sting operation to see how far he could go taking a study that he did the study. He didn't fabricate it, but he did everything possible to get the results he wanted. So one thing he did was he used very, very small samples. Another thing was he had multiple outcome variables so that his chances of having one of them be statistically significant was very, very high. So he didn't know what it was going to be, whether it was going to be weight loss or BMI or better sleep or better complexion or better sex or reduced back pain. He asked enough questions with these two small groups that he knew he was going to get some positive results. The third thing he did, he really was going for weight loss. He thought that would be the best thing to do. Most of the people in the study were women, and he timed their participation so that their menstrual cycles would lose weight at the end of the study. The group that was having the chocolate was losing weight due to their cycles.
Their cycles were ending, so they were no longer bloated.
So then he took his study, his terrible, terrible study, and he paid $500 on a credit card to get it submitted to a peer-reviewed online journal, which published it. And then he sent out press releases, and the media ate it up, because if you're a journalist or an online media source and you're looking for clicks and virality, what's going to get more clicks? Broccoli helps you lose weight, or dark chocolate helps you lose weight?
Yeah, it's scary. What you guys do exceptionally well in the book is apply more solid scientific principles to a reanalysis of, I think, literally hundreds of studies to come to the conclusion that we're just eating way too much protein.
Yeah, we looked at 699 studies in the book, and we actually put studies through filters. When you look at all the studies, the hundreds of thousands of studies on nutrition, and specifically looking at meat and looking at vegetables and plants and animals and fats and carbohydrates, when you take those hundreds of thousands of studies and you apply some filters to them, the number drops a lot. So what we did was we said, well, let's look at these filters. Let's look at peer-reviewed studies that the data is good, the funding is transparent, even if it's funded by dairy, that we didn't necessarily exclude it, but we said, well, let's be aware that there's a funding bias. And there are studies that show that, for example, studies of soda funded by the beverage industry never find harm for soda, whereas studies funded independently find harm most of the time. So when we ran these various filters about the quality of the research, about known conflicts of interest, about whether the statistical analysis and adjustment was done in a way that we don't think is appropriate, we ended up with a whole bunch of studies, and they largely pointed to this conclusion that human beings are meant to eat lots of plants, complex carbohydrates, and small to no amounts of animal product. And when you look at the variation of evidence, the different kinds, the epidemiological evidence, clinical trials, benchtop studies, biochemical assays, extreme outliers, people who eat nothing but raw fruit and run ultramarathons, the overwhelming data point to a plant-based whole food diet as the healthiest for human beings.
Eat what grows.
Eat what grows. We say in the book, eat the earth's bounty.
So, I mean, I have to tell you, it was an extraordinary relief to me, because I've done a bunch of reading myself, but I haven't had the time and energy to go through the scientific rigor that you went through. I tended to gravitate towards authors that I thought were more respectable as scientists, and I have enough training in my background to know who those are. And I was leaning more and more and more towards a vegan diet, and my protein was trending downwards, but I was worried about becoming too high glycemic if I had too much brown rice or potatoes, and so I was trying to cut that out of my diet, but I was still trying to get 150 grams of protein every day through beans and nuts, and I just wasn't physically comfortable, and it just didn't seem like I should be eating so many beans and so many nuts. And when I read the book, I said, you know, it's okay if I have a sweet potato or two during the day. It's okay if I have the brown rice. And I've just found the whole thing so much easier to maintain since I did that. And there's still a little part of me in the back of my brain that says, well, is this wrong? Am I going to have a heart attack because I'm doing this? Because personally, my triglycerides can spike if I have too much starch. It tends to be more related to flour and sugar than it is to whole grains or sweet potatoes. And it's more related to my weight overall. When my weight is at a normal level, then I don't have any problem with my triglycerides at all, when I'm as thin as I really need to be. So the thing that really came as a relief to me is I said, well, you know, this is a much easier diet to maintain. I'm going to stay thin by eating like this. And, you know, and I think I'm going to stay effortlessly thin by eating like this. So I guess I'm saying that there's still a part of me even reading the book that it's just such a radical difference from everything we've been enculturated to believe, that there's a part of me that worries, you know, I'm going to have a heart attack and die if I follow this, but it just seems so much more natural. It just seems so much easier and it makes so much more sense. I'm wondering if you can speak to that at all.
Yeah, I think most of us, there's a Yiddish expression, with one ass you can't dance at two weddings. I think most of us are trying to dance at multiple weddings.
Could you say that in Yiddish?
No. Tanzen nicht in zwei Chottenes. Somebody who knows Yiddish is going to call and sue us for that.
Haben Wurzel auf den Tukas. Go ahead.
Ah, awesome. We know we're supposed to eat our veggies, right? Because that's been drilled into us. But we also have to have our protein. And now that, you know, potatoes and rice and brown rice even is no good. The problem is we have no source of calories anymore. So if I just want to eat broccoli, a pound of broccoli has about 100 calories. So if I want to get my 2,000 calories for the day, I've got to eat 20 pounds of broccoli. That means I have a new job. It's called eating broccoli all day.
Right.
I can't do anything else.
Right.
I'm just eating salad. If I'm eating greens, if I don't eat the starches, then I'm simply going to be hungry all the frigging time. The best thing to do is just to go to these other countries, right? Because we're ensconced in this weird normal where everybody's sick. 50% of us are going to die of heart disease. Almost all of us are going to die. The 15 leading causes of death are all food-related to some extent or other, with the exception of accidents, and you could argue that alcohol plays a role there. But when you go to Sardinia or almost anywhere in Asia or Hawaii, where people are still eating a traditional diet, you see people thin and healthy. And as soon as those people switch to a Western diet, whether by migration to the United States or Argentina or by assimilation, you know, that's the second or third generation of Japanese in Hawaii are eating the standard American diet. They've got diabetes, they've got heart disease, and they've got all the ills and symptoms of the diet. So we know that when people change from a high-carb, low-protein, low-fat diet to the American diet, that they start looking like Americans and they start getting American diseases.
And the evidence couldn't be stronger for that. Well, Howie, I only have another couple of minutes today. I have a whole bunch of more questions. I'm wondering if I could have you back another time to do a follow-up about the same book?
Totally.
In the meantime, can you tell people a little bit more about where to get the book and why they should get the book and any other really key takeaways you want to leave them with?
Sure. The book is called Proteinaholic. The lead author is Garth Davis. It's available pretty much everywhere books are sold. So your big online stores, your local indie shops. There's ebook editions for Nook, Kindle, and Kobo. We don't yet have an audio version out, but I'm hoping that they're going to get Garth to do one because he has a very impassionate voice and it would be a great listen to hear him ranting the book. I think people should get it if they are like you and they kind of really sort of embrace this idea that we should be eating more plants, but this voice in your head is saying, yeah, but what about the potatoes, the corn, the fruit, that they can't totally do it because they're so scared of carbs. So this is kind of a cure for carbophobia. It will instill a healthy fear of animal-based protein. Also, I'd love people to read it who are currently on high-protein diets. 6 weeks or even 6 months on a high-protein diet can feel pretty wonderful. You're cutting out probably a lot of junk, the donuts and the cookies and the pizzas and stuff, and you're probably going to lose a lot of weight for various reasons that have nothing to do with health. But after about 6 months, people start feeling bad. And the cognitive dissonance means that a lot of people try to ignore it. If you're one of those people, weight's starting to come back on, you're feeling a little sluggish, you've got more aches and pains, maybe you went to the doctor and your numbers are worse and they're putting you on more meds or higher doses of meds, read the book and it could save your life.
Wonderful. Okay, well, I absolutely endorse it. That's a good way to describe it. It's the cure for carbophobia. It's Proteinaholic. Just hop over to Amazon and grab it, and I think everybody should do that right this very moment.